Thank you, Dana. It is good to be here with you. And I do enjoy the classroom. And Dana didn't tell you that the class that he was a part of was I believe we had almost 15 hours together. And so to try to take what happens in 15 hours and condense it down to 4 is difficult. And so this won't be exactly the same thing that we did there. I'm going to save some of the more biographical details for the second session. For now, I want to remember with you something that took place 10 years ago, 2004, the day after Christmas, a large earthquake, 9.1 on the Richter scale, hit off the west coast of Sumatra in Indonesia. And this earthquake triggered a series of devastating tsunamis along the coast of the Indian Ocean. Now, a tsunami, as we know, is caused when there is a significant displacement of water because of shifting. Generally, the landforms in the ocean are shifting. It causes a displacement of water. And where the ocean is deep, all that you notice is that the water is moving very, very rapidly. But it really does not cause an increase in the depth of the water that much. But the water can begin to move at 500 miles per hour or greater. But when that rapidly moving water reaches coastal areas where it's much shallower, then the waveforms get very, very large. The 2004 earthquake reached surges of over 100 feet at places. The devastation from this tsunami was actually just incredible. Maybe to give a picture of the amount of energy that's unleashed in a tsunami. This particular ship, 2,600 ton in weight, was carried a mile and a half inland by the tsunami. In this particular tsunami, there were over 230,000 people killed. Some of the most troubling images from the tsunami were pictures from coastal areas where you have lots of people lining the beach watching the storm surge come in. And you know that every one of those people was drowned by it. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans about a tsunami. Look for it as I read. Oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and how inscrutable His ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been His counselor, or who has given a gift to Him that He might be repaid? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be glory forever. Amen. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Now, before we look at the tsunami in this passage, I want to focus on that last line. What is good and acceptable and perfect? All of us, every person that lives has a picture of what is good and acceptable and perfect. We have an idea of what that is. Now, this isn't my idea, but we have a picture of what is good, acceptable, perfect. And that picture is what we live our lives by. The kinds of foods we eat, how we relate to our neighbors, what to do on Friday night, it all flows from this picture of what we consider to be good, acceptable, and perfect. So underneath everything we do is a set of beliefs and values about what is worth doing and how we should do that thing. And we call that our worldview. Now, I'd like to define worldview for us the way I'm going to be using the word this evening. And the first two definitions are more analogies, metaphors. But a worldview is like a pair of glasses. It's like glasses. It's the way that we see the world, the way that we understand what it is that we're looking at. That's our worldview. Another way we could think of a worldview is it's like a carpenter's level. It's the way we determine or the way we evaluate what is normal. What's the way you ought to, what you ought to do and the way you ought to do it. Our worldview is that. Now, maybe a little more rigorous definition. A worldview is the set of head and heart commitments. We make commitments. We're making commitments all the time. We make commitments of our head. Those we may say are our beliefs. We make commitments of our heart. Those are our values. The things we think that are true. The things that we care about. So it's the set of head and heart commitments. What I believe. What I value. And these set of head and heart commitments are about the way the world really is. We're convinced we know the way the world is, how it works, and the way to best interact with it, how to really live well. One more piece to our definition. If a worldview is that set of head and heart commitments, about what that is, what I believe and value, about the way the world really is, that shapes what I do and how I do what I do. That's our worldview. So underneath all of our activity, you take everything that we did today is a set of beliefs and values. Now, I'd like to illustrate that by talking about the worldview that people, that a group of people in Turkey have. They believe that if you are walking down the street and you see a friend and they've just had a child and you want to compliment them on their beautiful baby, you have to be careful. What you have to do if you want to compliment them well and right, you have to say, "Ah, your baby looks like a donkey." Now notice they have a particular way of doing this, of complimenting. And it flows out of their set of beliefs and values, their worldview. What is that? Well, this group of people in Turkey believe that the atmosphere is full of spirits that we cannot see. And these spirits are malevolent. They really are not really happy creatures, and they're kind of looking for people to play tricks on, or worse. And so what we have to do is fool them. And so if we were to compliment a baby and say, "Oh, what a beautiful baby," then these spirits would hear that and say, we got to do something about this. You know, they're enjoying this beautiful baby. Let's do something to mess it up. So in order to deal with that, what you do is you act like you're not complimenting. "Ah, it looks like a donkey." That way the spirits are fooled. but your friend knows that it's a compliment. Now, I've chosen a story like that set in another land because all of a sudden we can see with crystal clarity, yes, how the worldview informs the way they're doing what they're doing. But everything we do also is formed by beliefs and values. Now back to our passage in Romans. And he says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." Notice he's recognizing that we have this worldview, this picture of what is good and acceptable and perfect. And he is calling us to become people whose worldview aligns with the way things really are. With what really is good and what really is acceptable and what really is perfect. And he begins to tell us how we can move our worldview toward that worldview. Because they're just not automatically aligned. We have to move them into alignment. And he says that if our worldview is going to come to match that which is truly good, truly acceptable, truly perfect, we're going to need to have transformed minds. But the tsunami in this passage is the first part. Do not be conformed to the worldview of this world. Do not let the dominant way of seeing reality, do not let that shape you, form you, into the way you think. And this conforming influence, this worldview of the age, is an incredibly powerful force. It is tsunami-like in its power. The worldview of this age is the default. It is what we will tend to understand as true and real, unless we actively cultivate an alternative understanding. An example of how powerful the worldview of this age is. In 1996, less than 30% of Americans were in favor of gay marriage. In 2012, notice it's almost 50%. That is an amazing shift in a short amount of time. And it's because this is a part of the spirit of this age, the worldview of this age. Another example, in 1969, 74% of Americans thought that premarital sex was wrong. In 1980, only 11 years later, 35% thought it was wrong. There is a worldview, a dominant perspective, that is powerful in getting people to think certain ways. And it'll get us to think those ways too, unless we cultivate an alternative understanding. And that's what Paul is calling us to do. So, this evening, what I'd like to do in this first session is try to paint something of what the world of this age, the worldview of this age is. So I'd like to just give three words that describe the worldview of this age. And then in the remaining sessions, 2 through 8, and so there's 2 this evening, 2 tomorrow evening, and 4 on Sunday, I want to develop 6 words that I think summarize the Anabaptist understanding of reality. So that's where we're headed. We'll jump into session 1. How would you describe the worldview of this age? What are those beliefs and values that are dominant today? What are the beliefs and values that are universally accepted here in America. Maybe just take a few moments. Any response to that?
Relativism.
And what do you mean by that? There's no absolute truth. There's nothing that we can really get a hold of as true. Okay, good. Who else? Selective morality, and it's connected to the relativism. But by selective, that's an interesting word.
You know, there's a real movement, a lot of concern about life and so on, but yet babies are born.
Yeah. As certain things become really, really wrong, while certain really wrong things are acceptable. I remember hearing a caller. This was years ago. I believe it was to Garrison Keillor, and someone called him and said, "Mr. Keillor, we can't relate to your stories of life in Minnesota." And, you know, a grandmother that you go to for Thanksgiving and turkey. So we can't relate to that. He said, anymore, our grandmothers probably live in a high-rise building in New York City and smoke cigarettes and have a live-in boyfriend. And Keillor's response to that was this. He said, you know, she really shouldn't be smoking cigarettes. That is a bad deal. But the live-in boyfriend's probably good for her. I think that's the kind of selective morality you're talking about. What else? What are the characteristics of the spirit of this age?
Denial of God and belief
in evolution. Okay. Yeah, a denial of God. And you're accompanying evolution with that. I'm assuming the connection is that there doesn't need to be a God to explain all that we see in the world if you accept evolution. Well, let's proceed. The world, the answers, or another way we could define worldview would be to say it's the answers that I give to fundamental questions. And there's three fundamental questions that I want us to consider here this evening as we look at the worldview of this age. The first one is the question of reality. What is? This is an extremely important question. What is? What really exists? A second fundamental question is the question of truth. Does truth exist? And if it does, is it possible to know what is true? The third fundamental question that I want to consider is the question of goodness. What is it that's truly, truly good? Not just what I think is good, not what you think, but is genuinely, substantively good. And the way we answer these three questions gives us insight into our worldview, into those basic beliefs and values that we hold. So I'm going to be trying to look at each one of these for the worldview of this age. And I'd like to tell a story for each one. And from that story, maybe try to tease out the belief and value that that is currently in vogue. So the first question, what is? What is? And the story that I want to tell here is actually I want to read a story and show it to you. It's a Berenstain Bear book. But remember the question, what exists? What exists? Come, the wonders of nature await you outside with me, Papa Bear, as your nature walk guide. In all my years as a nature guide, I've followed one rule far and wide: be alert for any sign or sound. The wonders of nature are all around. Yipe! Now there's a wonder of nature not many have seen. Wow, Papa Bear, we see what you mean. Ah, yes, nature is happening every minute, and some of us get very caught up in it. What is nature? Well, it's everybody and everything. A peacock's tail, a butterfly's wing, it's snails and stones and dinosaur bones, volcanoes, earthquakes. Cousin Liz, that's just a part of what nature is. Nature is the world of animals, from the biggest whale to the smallest flea. It's the world of plants, from the tiniest weed to the tallest tree. It's the earth itself, the rocks and soil, and from under the earth come coal and oil. Nature is every person, thing, and place here on earth, out in space. Nature is the sun, the moon, the stars, its faraway planets like Venus and Mars. It's the mountains, the valleys, the shore, the sea. Nature is you. Nature is me. Have we had the answer yet? Watch this. It's all that is, or was, or ever will be. You talk about a worldview, a clear worldview statement embedded in a children's book. It's right here. Notice the answer to the question, what exists? The only thing that exists is nature. That is what is physical. What is the physical is all there is. There is no God. There is no life after death. All we have is right now. And because the only thing that exists is the physical, science and technology are the only disciplines really worth studying, because they're the ones that deal with the physical. This understanding is called naturalism. Notice nature-ism. When we add an ism to a word, it takes it from being a perfectly legitimate description of reality to something that often is not. And in this case, naturalism is saying at the heart of existence, at the heart of reality, is the physical world. And that's all that exists. One of the most famous scientists of our time, Francis Crick, said this: you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. We're nothing but chemicals. The physical is all there is. There is no soul, there is no mind, there is no spirit. There is only brain and body in this understanding. And this is the worldview of the age we're living in. Second question, truth. Does truth exist? And if it does, can we know it? Can we access it? And if we could access it, could we communicate it? In 20 years of college teaching, Professor Robert Simon said he has never met a student that denies that the Holocaust has happened. But he says increasingly he is getting students who refuse to say that what happened in the Holocaust was wrong. Back 15 years ago, he said it was up to about 20 to 30% of his students refused to say it was wrong, and that number has risen. Another college professor, Kay Hoggard, teaches at Pasadena City College in California, writes that in her literature class, she now has trouble getting her students to make any declaration that some other, any kind of other activity is wrong. And she said it used to be that when they read the story, The Lottery, by Shirley Jackson. Have any of y'all ever read that story? The Lottery, Shirley Jackson. It's a short story. It's a gruesome story, really. It's set in New England, and it's about a town somewhere in the future that gets to the place where every year they have to have a ritual stoning. In order to keep the crops growing and so on, someone has to be stoned. And so they just pass the hat, and everybody draws a number, and the person that draws the wrong number is killed that year. And so they read this story, and then she asks her class, what's your response to this? She said, in the 70s, they would say, well, this is wrong. But she said, anymore, she can rarely get anyone to say it's wrong. The worldview of this age is that there is nothing universally true. And that is, our brother's already named it for us, relativism. Alan Bloom tells us that there is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes or says he believes that truth is relative. Relativism, Bloom says, is the great insight of our times. The worldview of this age. Another prestigious scientist, William Provine, says no inherent moral or ethical laws exist, nor are there absolute guiding principles for human society. The universe cares nothing for us, and we have no ultimate meaning in life. And that really does follow from relativism. If there is nothing absolutely true, then it makes sense that there is no meaning for me or for you. A postmodern writer says that we've come to the place where questions of ultimate concern about the nature of the good, the meaning of truth, and the existence of God are taken to be unanswerable and hence, in some fundamental sense, insignificant. There is no story for this age. And I'm using story with a capital S. Have you noticed that this generation likes story? This is a word that has come on the scene in the last 10-15 years in ways that hadn't been here before. But this generation likes small S story, but is completely opposed to capital S story. Now, what's the difference? A story with a capital S is a story that applies to everyone, not just those of us sitting here this evening, but it applies to Iraqis and Russians and people that lived 1,000 years ago and 1,000 years from now. Stories like, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a universal capital S kind of story. And this generation isn't like that. But by the way, you know, they also don't particularly like the story of Darwinianism, because that also is a universalizing story, a story that applies to everyone. This is a generation that is now becoming much more okay with you having your story, you having your story, I having my story, and let's just enjoy each other. And it's one of the reasons the Mennonites today are appreciated more than they had been earlier, because, that's kind of a neat story that you have. Before I go on to goodness, maybe I'll just say one more thing here about relativism. Relativism insists that we should not be making universal claims of truth. Like, we should not say things like Jesus is the only way to God, because that applies to everybody. I remember a number of years ago in Thailand, And our taxi driver spoke some broken English, and so we were having an animated conversation. And somewhere in the conversation, he said, "You know, my daughter is a Christian." I said, "Really?" And so I was saying, "You know, how did that come about?" "Oh," he said, "she was born on Christmas Day." And so I wasn't sure if that's why he thought she was a Christian. But so I asked him some questions, and with time it seemed like he was saying, "No, that she actually did convert from Buddhism to Christianity." And so I said, "Well, what do you..." I mean, it was clear he was Buddhist from things he was saying. I said, "So what do you, as a Buddhist father, what do you do with your daughter becoming a believer in Christ?" And he says, he says, "I'm fine with it." He says, "All religions are good, except Islam." That was his final comeback. But it's this idea that you can teach Jesus just as long as Jesus is not exclusive. A third component of the worldview of this age is an answer to the question of what is truly good. What is substantively good? A friend sent me an editorial from the newspaper in Harrisonburg, Virginia, this past week. And it was about the orientation to the public university there in Harrisonburg. And it described what happens when the students come there for college, and says that as part of their orientation exercises, so just imagine an auditorium maybe filled with the freshman class, and one of the things that they had them do was they said, "What we're going to do is just ask you to stand if you fit these categories." And they ask, one of the categories was, "Are you gay?" And so they'd ask them to stand. And then everybody else was to applaud. They ask, "Who here is a virgin?" And ask them to stand and applaud. And everybody else was to applaud them. And then they would do the others. "How many of you are not gay?" And we would applaud that. And "Who is not a virgin?" We'll applaud that. A number of years ago, the Christian music megastar Amy Grant went through a divorce, and I was reading a news article about the divorce, and in that Amy Grant said, "I know that God hates divorce. I know that's true, and I know that what I did was wrong." But she said there is another truth that's higher than that. And that is the truth that God wants me happy. And so therefore, I have total peace that what I'm doing is good. The way the worldview of this age answers the question of what is truly good is by saying that personal happiness. What is it that makes you happy? That's what's good. You see, it's the individual person that is the measure of all things. Individual rights are the highest rights. There is nothing that's always right or wrong. It depends on what makes you happy. And personal happiness, you being happy, me being happy, that trumps any commitments that I may have made. Where do I find what is good? It's inside of me. I, as an individual, have all that I need to be successful and healthy. The individual and individual happiness is what is good. I remember hearing an existentialist talk about what you should do. If you are driving down the road and you see an old lady crossing the road, he said, you could stop your car, you could get out, and you could help her across the road. Or you could gun your engine and run her down. said, I have no way of telling you which is good. I can only tell you that what you shouldn't do is nothing. You need to do something to authenticate yourself. Do what it is that makes you happy. That's the only direction that he could give. In maybe a more humorous way, I remember Yogi Berra, I'm told, said this: if you come to a fork in the road, take it. And that's something of the worldview of this age. Individualism. Now Paul says, do not allow yourselves to be molded by this worldview. This worldview says that there's no universal truth, that the physical is all there is, that the individual and the individual's happiness is the highest value. Relativism, naturalism, individualism. The worldview of this age is powerful. It will shape us into its mold without us knowing that it even happened. It will change our thinking and in the process convince us that we are free and independent thinkers. The worldview of this age is pervasive. The things we talked about, naturalism, relativism, individualism, are all embedded in the media, in so many, it's just in the air that we breathe. It's in the activities, the practices, it's all around us, these views. And it's shaping, it's powerful. It convinces us, without us even knowing it, that what it is saying is the truth. It is tsunami-like. And a tepid response to this tsunami will not form a generation that is aligned with the beliefs and values of the kingdom of God. Is there a way forward? It's a question we want to keep thinking about. And that's where I'd like to end this session. We'll take about a 10-minute break. That puts us, if we could get started, at 25 after. And we'll go to part 2. You are dismissed.